and his alleged co-conspirator, Navy Chief Juan Arnez. The President Arce has sworn in new heads of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. We will speak online with our guest, who's in Cochabamba, Bolivia, Catherine Lederer, who is director of the Andean Information Network. You can go to democracynow.org for that report. But we have to end now. We wish a very happy birthday to John Randolph and let you know about a job opening at Democracy Now! We are currently accepting applications for a director of development. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Shrifido Kudus, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. Tune into our specials next week on July 4th and 5th, and you can watch any broadcast and any podcast wherever you get your podcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Do you love music but don't have the energy to find new stuff? Can't decide whether you want to hear indie rock or hip-hop, electronic music or singer-songwriters? Then tune into Another Late Night every first Saturday at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Community Radio. Or stream online at kboo.fm/anotherlatenight, where we've got it all.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Pacific Northwest family's tragedy is at the heart of a lawsuit against Amazon. Wildfire season gets underway in Oregon with evacuations in Deschutes County. And how people in Oregon's agricultural and farming communities are more at risk for suicide and what's being done to help them. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 27, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Amazon, one of the leading employers in the Pacific Northwest, is the target of a lawsuit from a family that lost their son in the Camas, Washington area. Amazon sold a chemical that some people used for suicide. But as Eric Tegedoff reports, the company says that's not what its product was intended for and that it shouldn't be held responsible.
Lawsuits are seeking to hold Amazon accountable for selling a chemical that was used by people for suicide. The substance is known as sodium nitrite and is usually used as a food preservative at low concentrations. The families of 15 people who died from the substance have sued Amazon in six separate cases. Caitlin Cherf, an attorney in Seattle, is defending the family of Tyler Schmidt, a 15-year-old who died by suicide in 2020 near Camas.
If a 15-year-old can't buy cough syrup like NyQuil or Robitussin at the drugstore, they should not be able to buy a suicide drug on Amazon.
Plaintiffs in the cases say Amazon knew as early as 2018 that it was selling a product that was used for suicide. In 2022, Amazon changed the process for buying sodium nitrite so that purchasers had to get it from a business account. Etsy and eBay stopped selling the product in 2019. Amazon says it can't be held responsible if people misuse its products. The company is attempting to have some of these cases, including the Schmidt family case, thrown out. A court of appeals hearing is scheduled for July 16th. Cherf says the company is not only selling sodium nitrite at high concentrations, as high as 99%, but also that the way it bundles products can push people to suicide.
When you look at the algorithms and the products being sold in conjunction with sodium nitrite, the effect of Amazon's actions and inaction was to promote suicide.
Cherf says there's a push to ban the sale of sodium nitrite to minors completely in Washington state.
At any purity level, our goal would be to have it prohibited. The proposal would also ban sales to adults over like the 10% concentration level.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A wildfire that started and quickly grew to more than 3,000 acres in Deschutes County has forced more than 1,000 people to evacuate from their homes. And fire forecasters and experts warn the toughest months, July, August, and September, are still ahead. This week, they met with members of Oregon's congressional delegation, including U.S. Senator Ron Wyden.
We're in the first of the fire season, and I'm saying to myself, Mother Nature has given us a bit of a boost this time. Did a little better in terms of rainfall and snowpack and the like, but Father Time has taught us with the climate crisis that these fires are bigger and more powerful. They're not your grandfather's fires. So I said, in my opinion, wonderful people who help us on the front lines, they're still gonna have their hands full. And that's what we wanna talk to you about is what kinds of efforts will really be helpful to you. Most of you know that I wrote the law several years ago to end fire borrowing, this outrageous practice where prevention money was being raided. The three of us have gone in on a whole host of issues together. Certainly the Inflation Reduction Act, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, has brought us millions of dollars to start with some of the state-of-the-art kinds of approaches, particularly with prescribed burns, so that you all who've told us a lot about the tools you need can go in during the colder weather kind of season. But obviously there's a lot more to do, and that's really what we're here to listen to in terms of your perspective. And I always wrap up the fire briefings on my side, and we're especially interested in hearing what you would work on if you were in our shoes. Senator Merkley is a powerful member of the Appropriations Committee. I'm chair of the Finance Committee. The Congresswoman is moving up in seniority in the House, and we believe will be chair next year. Not going to do any politics or anything, but you've got three of us who work together on these issues and particularly see this as part of our job to get you the tools and the resources so we can see you go do your thing. Senator Merkley.
There's always a sense of hope and dread at this gathering. What will this coming season look like? How bad will it be? And it's been such a transformation over the last few decades in terms of the length of the fire season, the severity of it. I never could have envisioned before 2020 we'd have forest fires take out six towns and part of six more towns burn to the ground. And when all of us toured those towns and saw the remains, it was just something that is burned into our minds about how lethal these fires can be. It's why we're so focused on the prevention practices, forest management strategies, prescribed burns, including thinning and mowing, and then having the resources to make sure we fight fires. I was struck by the number of fires in an overview, if it's accurate, that we have 2,000 or had 2,000 last year in Oregon, and hundreds of thousands of acres burned. Where are those fires going to be this year? Where are the lightning strikes going to be this year? We're here to say we're trying to back you up with resources. As chair of the Interior Spending Committee, both the BLM and the Forest Service money comes through that. And where we stand right now is we have about $4 billion in FY24 funding for fighting fires and $6 billion in the Wildfire Suppression Reserve Fund. We have been determined, as Ron said, to make sure that we don't run out of money. We ended robbing Peter to pay Paul a few years ago, but a devastating fire season across the country could change that. It's still possible to end up in that land. We want to make sure you have the equipment you need. We've all supported the training of the Oregon National Guard, and that funding has come through my subcommittee. And here we go. Let's hope that this is an excellent summer. I know your technology continues to change, and I'm always interested in how that's contributing to us having a better handle on the fires, responding fire faster, and so forth.
And that was Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley talking to a group of Oregon firefighting experts. Meantime, Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray has been sounding her own alarm about a 1% cap on the country's spending that's not related to defense.
Here in Washington, D.C., we call it non-defense discretionary spending, or NDD. Very wonky. Back home, we call it making sure parents have child care, helping families put food on the table, supporting quality, affordable health care in our communities, fixing our roads. Back home, we call it clean water, safe food, fresh air, affordable housing. When air traffic controllers keep our planes operating safely, that's NDD. When FDA pulls an unsafe product off the shelf, that is NDD. When kids go to a public school or get a Pell Grant that makes college possible for them, that's NDD. NIH researchers working to cure cancer, weather forecasters warning us of a disaster, agents cracking down on the flow of fentanyl and going after criminal organizations, fighting wildfires, enforcing sanctions against Russia, negotiating tough agreements with allies and adversaries alike, that is NDD. So I hope I've made my point. What we are talking about here is spending that is by no stretch of the imagination the largest portion, judge it, just about 1/8 of our total budget. But that makes a real tangible difference in families' lives and our country's safety and success every single day. We're also talking about things Americans overwhelmingly support. Seriously, I encourage my colleagues to go ask your constituents in any part of this country, conservative, liberal, Washington to Kentucky, do you care if you have clean water? Do you care if your kids get sick from foodborne illness? Do you want to wait longer when you call the Social Security office if you can reach anyone at all? Do you want someone making sure that the bridges that you drive across are safe? Do you want to stall our progress on cures and treatments for cancer or Alzheimer's or other deadly diseases? And yet NDD has been consistently underfunded, and it is a constant target for cuts by House Republicans, as we are now seeing. I'm here to say enough is enough. If we keep cutting and stretching and shortchanging those programs, something is going to snap, something important. But more cuts is exactly what a 1% cap actually means. Not treading water, not keeping up, a 1% cap means pain. If we let families down, that means we let our competitors get ahead. It means we leave our nation vulnerable. That's not politics, Mr. President. It is cold, hard math. 1% is not enough to keep up with rising costs, growing needs, and new challenges. The issue here isn't whether we can make more tough choices. It is whether we're going to be honest about the tough realities of a 1% cap. There are so many priorities lawmakers on both sides of the aisle care about that can't happen with a 1% increase. Here's what a 1% means in practice. 1% means letting families go hungry. WIC, a literal lifeline for nearly 7 million mothers and babies, is going to need a nearly 10% increase next year. Anything less will force us to choose which moms, which babies are getting the food they need, and which are getting put on a wait list. Think about that. 1% means we are letting rural families lose their homes. We need a 5% increase for rural rental assistance alone. Falling short means thousands of rural families will lose assistance and may face eviction. How is that right?
That was Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray. She's the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, talking about possible cuts in the federal budget. Meantime, in Portland, advocates held a forum about the need for housing. It included Mercedes Elizalde, the director of advocacy at Latino Network. She explained what she sees as the key problems facing the Portland metro when it comes to the housing crisis.
My engagement around housing and housing policy has been many years in the making, really starting when my own family experienced housing insecurity in much the same way that most families experience homelessness, lots of couch surfing and sleeping with other families. I think for a long time, I saw my focus of work around specifically addressing poverty and education. But ultimately, when I got into direct service, I saw that the kiddos I worked with who had stable homes, the work that we did just lasted longer, had deeper impacts than the families who were struggling with housing instability. So I've been there and stayed there, I've circled the policy table a couple of times, working on the government side and also working in community. One of the challenges that we have with both understanding the scope and scale of our housing crisis and how to fix it is that we oftentimes talk about housing in isolation from other parts of our system. I think even in for Portland for All, like our housing and a homeless services conversation was separate, right? But these were separate issues that we were facing. And I think we oftentimes talk about housing over here, and then we talk about education over there, economics over there, social services over there, as if these things aren't connected. And I think that actually helps us to do this thing that we tend to do, which is if some individual person doesn't have housing, it's on them, because we're not talking about these things as they're interconnected. So we get to then treat this like it's a smaller crisis than it actually is, because if we were to take it in context of our full social and economic conditions, we would see our housing crisis is much more devastating than I think we're really paying attention to. Ultimately, I think the commodification of housing is really what continues to drive this. If we want to continue to say that housing builds wealth for average Portlanders, average people in the United States, then that means that housing also can't be affordable to the average person or the average household. And we continue to build our policies trying to hold on to that commodification while trying to squeeze in affordability and try to squeeze in abundance, when we really need to be pivoting and focusing on how are we building abundance and affordability. And separate from that, a question of how do we build long-term economic resilience once folks have that stable housing. So I think a big part of it is we're not really thinking about our housing as critical to all the other systems that we have in front of us. A lot of times this is what makes it difficult to build the kind of housing we need in the right places, the size of homes that we need for different family types. It also limits our engagement with choice around what other things we want in our communities and our neighborhoods, because we're continually fighting that commodification and continually treating housing as just like one of the widgets in our economic system that's building other people wealth, instead of thinking about it as a critical safety net that we should be investing in all of the time and making as abundant as possible. And so I think that's part of our key problem, is both how we look at housing in order to be able to build proper solutions. And I think the commodification of our housing market will continue to keep us in some degree of crisis if we don't face it head on.
Mercedes Elizalde is with the Latino Network. She's their director of advocacy. She spoke at a recent forum on housing by the Portland for All nonprofit group. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. And at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, cloudy skies down to 52. Tomorrow's weather, clouds and sun, a high around 80. Today in history, on this date in 2015, activist Bree Newsom removed the Confederate flag from the South Carolina State House. The quote of the day is from Bree Newsom. "I did it for all the fierce black women on the front lines of the movement and for all the little black girls who are watching us. I did it because I am free." Why are Oregon's farmers and ranchers at more risk for suicide? It's something that Cassie Bosky is researching.
I work for Oregon State University Extension Service. I'm an agriculture extension agent. I work on the south coast of Oregon in Coos and Curry counties. We have a lot of specialty crops. Eisenhower said farming looks mighty easy when your plow is a pencil and you're 1,000 miles from a cornfield. And I think that is a really accurate thing for those of us who aren't in the farming or ranching industries. It's easy to look at that and think it's just an idealistic job, idyllic, and that it's a great lifestyle. And I think people who do this work believe so. but they're also carrying around a lot of extra stressors that those of us who have the typical 9-to-5 work week where we get a paycheck, regular paycheck at the end of every month or twice a month or whatever, don't necessarily have to worry about. A lot of this just says farming, but I'm including ranching and any kind of agriculture production in here, but it's just easier to say farming. So that's what I mean there. But they've got a lot of stress factors that we don't deal with. Market fluctuations are a really big deal, and they don't have a lot of control over these things. A lot of them have very big debt loads, and financial pressures are high. They're dealing with the impacts of climate change, whether that's drought like we're talking about here today, or if it's flooding. There's just a lot of intense events that are happening that can have a very significant impact on their either crop or livestock production. We did a survey in Oregon, and they reported that drought and wind were there when they talked about climate and what the most stressful. And then we've got a population that is relatively isolated. They work long days and they live in medically underserved areas. So they may not have access to the kind of health care and mental health care that those of us who live in more urban type areas do. There's additional risk factors that they're dealing with too. You look at the financial pressures. You may have had a farm or a ranch in your family for generations. Now you've got market problems. COVID was a prime example and really brought to the forefront that a lot of these industries aren't cost plus industries. They are at the mercy of the market for the financial compensation they get for their products, and they're not able to build in their expenses. And when fertilizer prices triple, fuel prices double, there's a lot of input costs that have gone up dramatically for them, and they don't necessarily see that coming back to them. Add into that a culture of rugged individualism, where any sort of admit or talking about mental health or maybe being depressed and admitting that to somebody may be looked at as a sign of weakness, or even the person themselves may be unwilling to talk about it or deal with depression or anxiety because of the stigma around mental health issues in this community. And it makes it hard for them to get the help that they need. When we have stressors start to build up and never end, it's just a chronic stress problem. It results in physical and mental problems in our bodies. And mental health problems can devolve into suicidal thinking. So we look at the nature of ag work, and you've got financial stress. There's pressure to never lose the family business. The work itself is physically and mentally stressful, and the hours are long. It's socially isolating, and they may not have somebody they feel confident confiding in when there are problems. You add to this the onset of mood disorders that go untreated and a reluctance to seek help, and you have the formula to set up the necessary conditions for suicidal behavior, which of course is what we want to avoid at all costs. Suicide rates across the country, the national rate is 14.5 per 100,000. We've seen that rural areas have higher rates of suicide than urban areas. There's a lot of reasons for that, but lack of good access to care is one of them. The reason why I'm able to do the work I'm doing, somebody brought this suicide statistics to Congress, and they allocated a bunch of money in the 2018 Farm Bill to do outreach around suicide prevention in the agriculture industry. And the rates of suicide in this particular population is about 3.5 times that of the general population of the U.S., about 48 males per 100,000 in comparison to 11 females per 100,000. There's a difference there. Males tend to have a 4 times higher rate of suicide than do females. So this is the reason why this program exists. Part of the outflow of that has been the Western Regional Agricultural Stress Assistance Program, or RASIP. And this is a group of 14 Western states and some territories on the Western U.S., and basically, they've put together a really amazing resource clearinghouse where if you go there, you can find your state, and it will provide you with a list of the different health, mental health resources that would be available to you. You can find this at farmstress.us. The first iteration of the Farm Bill project was the Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance Network, and we're underneath that Western Region one. This is the one we developed at Oregon State University. You can find our suicide prevention trainings. We do a lot of those every year. A lot of them are on Zoom, and we provide some other resources for education and outreach about farm stress and suicide prevention. And all of this has been, of course, grant funded, but we provide these trainings and they're called QPR, and that stands for question, persuade, and refer. And what they are basically is an hour to an hour and a half training where we teach you what to watch for in someone who may be struggling with severe stress or even suicidal thinking, what to watch for, and then how to talk to them and get them help. And that's all that training's about. We've got a couple coming up at the end of the summer. AgriSafe has an AgriStress helpline that's available in 10 states across the U.S. Oregon, Washington, and Montana are three of those states.
Cassie Bosky is with the OSU Extension Service. House Republicans consider arresting Merrick Garland. Abortion bans are proving to be expensive for states, and data suggests Biden's snap immigration executive orders are working. For the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
This is something that would enable the Speaker of the House to order the Sergeant at Arms to take into custody the Attorney General if he fails to comply with our request.
Florida Republican Representative Anna Paulina Luna will force a vote on an inherent contempt resolution against Attorney General Merrick Garland. Garland was held in contempt of Congress for not turning over tapes of President Joe Biden's interview with Special Prosecutor Robert Hur, but the Department of Justice, led by the AG, has refused to act. Inherent contempt requires the House Sergeant-at-Arms to bring the accused before the chamber to be tried and possibly detained. Like much of what the House has done recently, this hasn't happened in almost a century. While some wonder if this will distract from governing, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson says having the audio is imperative.
We've got to have the audio tape to confirm what is on the written transcript.
Speaker Johnson says he's eager to see Trump's performance at tonight's televised debate. The Biden campaign is dismissing Trump camp charges the president will use drugs to improve his debate performance. One spokesperson calls demands for a drug test silly. 2 years after the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, a Guttmacher Institute report says the number of abortions increased and more are via medications. New analysis from the Institute for Women's Policy Research shows financial costs of abortion bans.
The 16 states that have an abortion ban or extreme restriction cost the national economy $68 billion alone. For states that actually protect abortion, those states reduce these costs.
Their research says Arkansas, Mississippi, and Missouri would have slightly higher GDPs if they removed abortion restrictions, while women's labor force participation nationwide would vastly increase. President Joe Biden's executive actions to limit southern border crossings seem to be working. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says
Border Patrol encounters have dropped by over 40%. We are removing more non-citizens without a legal basis to stay here.
Yesterday marked the 11th anniversary of the Supreme Court's ruling on Shelby County v. Holder, which overturned parts of the 1965 Voting Rights Act and made it easier for states to put up barriers to voting. Alabama Democratic Representative Terry Sewell says the impacts since the decision are devastating for voters' rights.
We have seen 31 states institute at least 103 new laws to restrict voting access. Those laws disproportionately target Black and minority voters.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
A ceremony in Yellowstone to honor the birth of a rare white bison. With that story and much more, here's National Native News.
Native people from across the country attended a ceremony honoring a white bison calf. Hannah Merzbach reports, many indigenous people say the birth fulfills a prophecy.
A few hundred people gather around a stage in West Yellowstone, listening to Lakota Chief Arvel Looking Horse, keeper of the sacred white buffalo calf pipe and bundle. He compares the bison birth to the second coming of Jesus Christ.
My heart is so heavy. I just want to cry. I can't believe that this is happening.
White bison are sometimes born in captivity to parents with cow DNA, but Looking Horse says this one is wild, a blessing and a warning.
We're going to see a lot of sicknesses and viruses. We're going to see false leaders, false prophets.
Or Looking Horse says nations can unite spiritually and create a, quote, energy shift, using indigenous practices to protect the environment and sacred animals. I'm Hannah Merzbach.
The Native-led organization Indian Collective is holding a caravan drive Thursday in Rapid City, South Dakota, calling for the release of Leonard Peltier. Lee Strubinger has more.
Nick Tilson is the president and CEO of Indian Collective. He was one of two witnesses who testified in favor of Peltier's release. Peltier is serving two life sentences in federal prison after being convicted for taking part in a fatal shootout between American Indian Movement members and FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975. Tilson says the fight for Peltier's release is an uphill battle, but he says he left the parole hearing with a little hope.
One of the reasons why we all fight for Leonard so fiercely is how Leonard was treated during his prosecution and during his continued incarceration is consistent with how they have treated Indian people throughout history.
Tilson says Indian Collective has purchased a house for Peltier on the Turtle Mountain Reservation in North Dakota, where Peltier is enrolled. He says he outlined Peltier's reentry plan, including helping Peltier get signed up for programming services through IHS, community health, as well as building a sweat lodge near the home. Kevin Sharp is Peltier's lawyer. He says if parole is approved, he expects an appeal from those opposed to his release. Then, he says Peltier would start reentry.
Leonard would likely be transferred to a medical facility while we work on getting the process inside the Bureau of Prisons, BOP, taken care of. Could likely take months to actually get him out. And so that's where we are. If it is denied, then our next step is to appeal to the National Appeal Board.
If they lose the parole hearing, Sharp says it could take years to appeal through the courts. Peltier's supporters feel time is of the essence. Sharp says Peltier's health is failing. His next parole hearing would be in 15 years, which he says Peltier likely would not make it. I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff and Edwin J. Vieira. Your producer's Annette Newell, and our engineer's Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.